This is Wade Reske, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice for the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on these websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Professor Martin Shainhalls, an anthropologist at Appalachian State University, who's written a very interesting book, particularly in our hard and dark times, called Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. Welcome to Wade's World, Marty Shainhalls.
Thank you, Wade. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you here. So here with, you know, we're in the clouds and fog of war and the White House and whatever. Utopia.
Yeah.
Who's talking about utopia? Go, Marty.
Yeah, all right. Well, we really need it, don't we?
Oh, my God. I mean, we're about ready to jump on any train, but, you know, there are worse places to go than utopia. Give us a, when you say you're reimagining equality, what are you talking about here, Marty?
Okay, so one of the things is lots of us on the left, of course, have stressed, and lots of other people have stressed the importance of equality. But what I wanted to do is to really give it a scientific basis and to say, why is it that utopia, equality matters for utopia? And what I argue is that, and again, it's a little bit intuitive, but nonetheless important, and that is that the happiest society is an egalitarian one. And I show that using social science and biology. Just quickly, I'll tell you, I look at the evolution of the emotions, and the negative emotions most likely evolved in conjunction with the dominance hierarchies, the pecking orders that we all learn about in junior high or high school. So hierarchy is associated with anger, with fear, with submission. And happiness and joy most likely evolved with the mammalian capacity and desire to nurture their own offspring so that mammals get great happiness and joy from being nurtured and from nurturing. And in humans, we extend that most generally, not just to our offspring, but to nurturing other humans. We have that capacity, and that's what really brings us the happiest emotions.
And you really seem to believe that we have sort of a right to be joyful.
We absolutely do. Absolutely. That the emotion of joy evolved to make us both attend to our own needs, but also to other people's needs, to be pro-social, as people call it. And sometimes joy and pleasure, those words have a little bit of a negative connotation, especially pleasure, but they shouldn't, because they're what encourage us in evolutionary terms and to interact with each other and to be helpful to each other. I know it all sounds so unrealistic in the world today, but actually if we look at the history of humans, going back 200,000 years, for most of our history, we lived as a cooperative, sharing species. It's only in the last few thousand years we've been warlike and hierarchical.
So hierarchy, you think, is a key problem?
I do. And an important thing to say about it is it's a key problem, not only, of course, it's a key problem for people who are on the bottom of the hierarchy, the poor, the disenfranchised, but it doesn't lead to happiness for people on the top either. I actually think of hierarchy as being an actual addiction in the sense that people who want money are never satisfied with whatever they have. They keep needing more. That's a classic addiction, addictive behavior. And the other aspect of an addiction is that people will do anything to get the drug, even if it's destructive to themselves or to those around them. And you can see people in their craving for power acting in such a destructive way, self-destructive and other destructive. So hierarchy doesn't lead to happiness. Being on the top doesn't lead to happiness. We have to change society in order that all of us can realize our happiest selves.
There's a philosophical argument that dates back centuries, almost a religious argument about whether or not our purpose in life is this sort of pursuit of happiness, or whether or not our lot in life is sort of bearing the mortal coil that we suffer through, we do the best we can. And it goes back to, you know, St. Thomas of Aquinas and St. Francis. How do you reconcile all those pieces? I mean, there are many people who still believe very stoically that, you know, life is just shoulder to the wheel, doing the best you can. You know, it's the pain. You know, it's a dark place. It's not the sort of happy place that you're saying we would find in utopia.
Absolutely. It is a dark place, and it's a place that we don't need to be in. Of course, what you reference in religion, I'd also add on the Puritans and the puritanical notion of work, that work is something to be suffered through. And because we suffer, we somehow are more virtuous. To me, that is not a very intuitive and logical idea. And the other thing is it divides us in half, because then half of us wants to do things that are pleasurable, but we, according to the puritanical view, find pleasure to be guilt-inducing. And then when we are supposedly being good, we're also suffering. And so we're pulled in two directions. And that's a really horrible and dishonest way to live.
It's just, how do we... So you embarked on this exercise as a philosophical exercise or as a practical prescription. How do you see, and you've already sort of said, you know, given these times, it's hard for people to grab utopia as realistic. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to imagine some progress in the areas that you're outlining?
There is, absolutely. I wanted it to be both broad and philosophical, but also to be really practical and concrete. And so I give specific ideas in the book. And one of the ideas I'm really glad has come back into the political discourse among the Democrats, and that is the fact that with automation, we're running out of enough work for people. And that puts us at a fork in the road. One thing to do would be to say, okay, you know, robots will produce everything, but none of us have any work, so we can't buy or somehow obtain any of the things that are produced, and we'll all starve to death. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. The other thing is to say, well, if we have all of these robots doing the work, and I'm not saying that they'll reproduce, that they'll replace everything and everyone, but it's a good thing. It frees up time for all of us to engage in things because we want to do them, if we don't have to live in the fear that we're going to have to work huge numbers of hours, otherwise perishing. You know, we can give right now enough food and housing and health care and the basics of subsistence to all humans the world over. And I show that really carefully in the book, because I know that there's a kind of skeptical discourse that says we don't have enough, but we do. And we should.
We're talking to Marty Shane Halls about his new book that looks at utopia. Marty, you spent a lot of time worrying about agriculture and who's going to do the farming. That's hard, thankless work for many people, and for other people, it's a job they've done, you know, for generations. How do you sort that out in this in your notion of the future?
Yes, so it is and can be hard, thankless work. And to the extent that it is, it's something that all of us should engage in. I show that if all of us engaged in a small number of hours of agricultural work, that we could produce enough food to feed the entire world. And so I imagine that everyone who's capable and everyone who's willing, because ultimately I don't want anything to be totally coerced, but everyone will engage in a small number of hours of labor, and agriculture would be one part of it. And by small, I'm talking about, you know, maybe an hour a week or less. Agriculture has become so efficient that, you know, in the 1920s, half of us were farmers, and now a tiny percentage in America produce food. And we can share that labor, and we can share more generally the labor that's necessary for subsistence, so that all of us can share in that greatest bounty, which is to say time to engage in the things that we really want to. And by saying that, I'm not saying that we'll all sit at home and do something, you know, we could, but I want the economy in Utopia. I've designed it so that it will guarantee the resources for people to engage in the creative pursuits that are meaningful to them, and to provide them also with the audiences that can appreciate those creative pursuits. So no more starving artists without an audience for their work.
We'll all be starving, it sounds like. But there are two kinds of questions that are raised on the agricultural issue. One is, and at least, you know, speculating about Utopia, one is that efficiency, so much of the efficiency in farming and food production has been tied to, you know, fertilizer.
Yeah.
Many countries, very energy intensive, dependence on mechanization, petrochemicals. And you argue, obviously, that in your book, that climate is important. And right now, I think, what is it, 35-38% of the globe is in arable production. What kind of, in order to get us all down to an hour or two a week or whatever it is, how do you put all those pieces together, Professor?
Yes, well, that's a complicated argument, something I do look at in the book really carefully. But just to say a few pieces of it, one of the things, there's huge food wastage in the world today, and some of it is because huge amounts of food in the places where I've done my research, in China, in India, food doesn't get to the people who need it. There's a lot, huge amount of wastage of food. There are, in China, there are many, many people who aren't, who are living on the farms, but their labor isn't really needed. So there's a lot of surplus labor. And the same is true in a lot of parts of India. You're right about the issue of the carbon footprint and the petrochemical industry. And that's something that obviously I think anyone who wants a utopia should be concerned about. But there also are a lot of innovations that are coming along that are consistent with reducing the carbon footprint. Innovations in agriculture that would still reduce the number of hours that people work. And it's also possible that there's nothing intrinsically unlikable about a lot of different activities, including agriculture. In China, it's low status, and so people hate it in part because it's low status. But, you know, look at in America, in parts of America where people get their college degrees, and then they choose to open up a farm, and they feel more engaged and doing meaningful work having a farm. So I don't want to denigrate all kind of farm labor, because I think that the the saddest thing today is that the people who are most important to us, those who produce food, make so little and have such little status. And if we all shared in it and didn't see it as something that was done by, at least in China and in India, by the lowest status people, if we didn't see it that way, more of us might enjoy doing it. I'm absolutely quite sure of that.
Well, there's also the Impossible Burger, and, you know, the GMO and bioengineering are trying to figure out a way to, you know, replace milk, replace meat, replace, you know, this, that, and the other, and a plant-based thing. Is this something you think might be part of utopia? Because obviously there's controversy there as well.
I think it can, and it should be. The idea is to produce more efficiently, but to do so in a way consistent with also reducing the carbon footprint of agriculture. I'm not a specialist on all of those different things on the technical issues, but I provide enough in the book to show that we can do it and do it even with the predictions of the increases in the population that are coming, and do it with a decreased carbon footprint. And it's really important to say that because so many economists, especially those on the right, have a discourse of scarcity. There's not enough in the world, you know, so we all have to work harder and harder. And that's just not true.
Well, you argue in the book it's a moral argument, not an economic argument, correct?
It's both. It's both. I mean, that there's the economic reality of it, but it's also, yes, it's also a very moral argument that I'm making. Absolutely.
What do we do with the people who say they don't want to do their hour or two of agricultural work every week? How do we sort that out in utopia?
Yes, so I wouldn't coerce anyone, and I know that there are people who will say, even some people on the left, well, that's not fair. We should coerce people, and if they don't want to do it, that, you know, that is something that is a huge sticking point. But I think it's so important not to have any coercion in utopia that if someone doesn't want to do it, I wouldn't coerce them. And ultimately, if they really have objections, no one is required to belong to utopia. People could be given land to grow their own food outside of utopia, and it wouldn't be an ostracism putting them out of utopia. It would simply be that they would be able to come and go in utopia and just perform on their own according to their own desire. But I don't think there would be that many people who would choose that, but if they want to, they can choose that as well. The most important thing is that work should not be coerced, nor should learning.
So I guess we're talking to Professor Martin Schoenhals from Appalachia State. He's written a very interesting book called Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. I guess two things surprised me in reading your book, Professor. One was the sort of in and out thing. You could have in utopia, there'd be a part of the world in utopia and part of it in some undefined not utopia. And now, given what your comment just was, that you could sort of come in and out, you know, of utopia, that surprised me. I thought we would pretty much, how would you have this sort of world like we have now at some level, plus this, you know, this golden utopia side by side? Would they be in different places? Would they, I mean, I had trouble getting my mind around that and didn't realize it until I was almost finished the book. And towards the last, I said, whoa, where are we?
Right. That came about because a friend of mine said, you know, what if I don't want to belong to your utopia? And I think it was a fair question. And I, by the way, encourage listeners and readers to correspond with me. I think it's really important to take everyone's ideas seriously and interchange in ideas. So it would not be
utopian itself.
Yes. Absolutely. I want to live my own ideals. So we wouldn't have the world as it exists today. There would be in that kind of, if there are people who choose to live in a outside of utopia, they still would subscribe to basic human rights based upon the, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written coming out of the end of World War II. Eleanor Roosevelt was quite instrumental in writing it. It's a really wonderful document, and it talks about the dignity of work and the provision to all people. And so that would be something that everyone would subscribe to. That would be a kind of basic minimum requirement. But the idea is that no one would be forced to be a part of utopia. And the coming in and out piece is that it's not like jail, where the people who are outside of utopia, you know, somehow are locked into their world, or the people in utopia wouldn't be able to visit the other people. I don't actually imagine the non-utopian sector being very large, but I don't know for sure. We've never had a utopia. We've never tried it, so I want it to be open to the possibility that it could exist, and to make the argument that utopia was going to be something that people wouldn't be coerced into doing. And that's really important, because I know so many people think of utopia as being autocratic, and it isn't, and it doesn't have to be.
Yet, you know, you can imagine, particularly as we reimagine equality, that having, you know, getting the Wall Streeters to come over and do their couple of hours of labor in the fields, let's say, you wouldn't want them to just come in and out to eat.
No. And they wouldn't be able to do that.
So they'd have to somehow sort out, you know, I mean, I'm not saying 1984-ish, but they'd have to, you know, somehow you'd have to know if they were visiting Utopia that they weren't just ripping and running.
Yes, absolutely. No, this would not be something where the Wall Streeters could continue to make a fortune and then come running in and enjoy a few utopian meals and run out.
Could they pay others to, you know, do their extra hours, sort of, you know, like the old
right,
draft
absolutely.
In the Civil War.
Which brings up something that I know economists might not like, but I want to get rid of money, because money is that store of value that allows people to do things like pay other people to do the work for them. And that, of course, would undermine the whole system.
The other surprise I had was you, in sorting out some issues, you create a system, I'm not going to call it judicial, but you call them judges or experts who would, you know, somehow weigh in on this. But I couldn't tell exactly how one selected these judges or how one prevented them from being corrupt. Or, I mean, we have problems with judges today, for goodness sake. You know, I live in places where we elect judges, and some places they just appoint them, and God knows what's going to happen to the Supreme Court and the hello world we're actually really living in. The judges thing was interesting to me. So tell our listeners and others how you thought about that in Utopia.
Sure. So one thing that's really important to say up front is, if you have paid judges and you are living in a society as we do today, in which money is the measure that people use to define their own success and define what they think is their own happiness, then of course you're going to get corrupt judges and corrupt everything. It's very, you know, the system is built for corruption. But what I imagine is, and it's not just imagined, let me say that in one of the places I worked in China in the mountains, the person who was most respected was the informal, humble person, not formally chosen, but a person who had good qualities and was benevolent, who became the kind of conflict resolver in the society. This is a small mountain community. And that's true in many parts of the world, that humans and even chimpanzees, by the way, look up to the person who's good at resolving conflict and doing it in a fair and benevolent way. And what that means is that when you don't pay people and when you aren't in a hierarchical situation, you can return to that basic human desire to invest, invest in someone who is humble and kind and a conflict resolver and look up to them. I mean, those were the people who were most looked up to, the humble ones and the generous people, the people who gave of their time in order to make other people, in order to get other people to get along. And so the judges in Utopia would be non-compensated. They would rotate in and out of service, a little bit like juries. Juries, I know in the American jury system, there have been all kinds of problems. But one thing that is good is the jury system doesn't entrench power in someone who uses their power and gets more and more power. You serve, you are off the jury, and that's it. And so I think that that model of rotation in service and then off service for those who are willing, including for judges, would be a good one and would lead to no entrenched power.
But in some cases, the burdens would be huge. You would have judges decide on some of these life and death questions as well, wouldn't you?
I wouldn't really.
I think there was a section about medical procedures, and judges might determine, you know, how that would work. Maybe I misread that.
The thing is, today, where everything is defined as limited, and where the way in which we measure everything, we resolve conflicts with money by taking it away from someone, giving it to someone else, or by taking away someone's freedom. And I know, again, this is going to sound Pollyannish, but it doesn't have to be. We can have a zero-sum kind of conflict resolution in which if someone feels that they're not getting enough attention or they're not getting enough of the basics in some way, they can go to the court and that can be rectified. And the goal will be to produce a kind of balance between two people, especially in the case of so many people, what they feel they lack is attention and affirmation. And you can convince one person to increase their attention to another without losing anything, right?
Well,
I mean, attention is something we can, it's not a limited quantity that we have.
That's certainly correct. I mean, even without money, there's, as we are finding out too often, there are other things that people barter. I mean, and taking advantage, obviously the hashtag MeToo thing, you know, shows how much sex becomes a kind of exchange. And clearly, before there was money, there was probably bartering. And even in many societies, including some like India, right now, there's still bartering in many cases along with money, particularly when you don't have cash money. And you're in Appalachia for low-income people, the bartering, you know, because food stamps and welfare are so limited in terms of cash payments now, there's a lot of bartering now, including sex. But this is, I have to say that Professor Shane Halls is right to encourage us to think about something better. How would people get a hold of this book, Professor, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined?
All they have to do is go to their favorite bookstore. I have to say, unfortunately, that the big one, Amazon, has the cheapest price by far, but that's not to encourage anyone to go for the cheapest price, but it's a little over $20 on Amazon. And if you type in Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, it'll come right up. But it's at anyone's favorite bookstore. It should be there.
And how can they get a hold of you in order to, if they have more interest and want to continue this conversation, and you've already encouraged people with questions or comment or suggestions, how can they get a hold of you, Professor?
Yes. So my email is the best way. It's M as in Martin, D as in Donald, S as in Shane Halls, newyork@gmail.com. So MDSNEWYORK at mdsnewyork@gmail.com, mdsnewyork@gmail.com. And I would love to hear from anyone.
And we have enjoyed talking to you about utopia. We don't get to do that much in Wage World. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wage World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wage World. Thank you.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, a grassroots effort to produce public radio news and information serving the needs of low and moderate income working Americans by providing a platform for voices not commonly heard in mainstream media. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.